This podcast is sponsored by Cloud Optimizer.
As a business owner or IT manager, are your cloud investment costs going up and you don't know why? It's time for Cloud Optimizer. As you migrate your business to the cloud, what you're spending and why you're spending it can get a little hazy. But Cloud Optimizer clears up the mystery and puts the cloud to work for you. Cloud Optimizer starts by analyzing usage patterns, right-sizing resources, leveraging discounts you may not be aware of, implementing automation, and much more. And by reducing unnecessary expenses and maximizing performance, Cloud Optimizer guarantees you a savings of 5 times what you spend for their service. As you utilize cloud-based services more and more, you don't have to lose sight or control of your spend. You can stay agile, streamline your costs, and optimize your performance, plus save significant money with Cloud Optimizer.
Make the cloud work for you with Cloud Optimizer. Get a free assessment and find out how much you can save by going to cloudoptimizer.com. Go to cloudoptimizer.com for your free assessment. That's cloudoptimizer.com.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
I mean, I certainly kind of consider myself to be the go-to person for, if you really want to have a conversation about what having kids is like, you know, and maybe want somebody to talk you out of it, come to Diane.
This is Death, Sex, and Money.
That's probably why they invented TiVo, so people could have sex.
The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot.
We both screw people for money.
And need to talk about more.
Why did you have to die?
I'm Anna Sale. I first met Diane Gill Morris on the Death, Sex, and Money Facebook page. We'd posted an article about people thinking about having kids, and Diane commented, "We have 2 teenage boys with autism. I love them deeply, but," she wrote, "if someone had told me that this is what it'd be like, I never would have had kids." We reached out to Diane in North Carolina, where she lives outside Raleigh.
I just feel like we live in a society where, especially, you know, now with Facebook, and everybody will post these great, beautiful pictures of their kids and talk about all their great successes and how wonderful things are. And I feel like sometimes it would benefit people to understand that you go into kids thinking that it's going to be this wonderful, amazing lifelong experience, and the reality is it may just take so much more from you than you would have imagined.
What she imagined was very different when she first met her husband, Greg. She was 18, a college sophomore. They were both studying journalism at the University of Missouri.
And I was in love with him within 3 weeks.
Why?
We just click. Like, you know, I was just crazy, but like I got home like literally after our first date and called my mother and I said, "Oh my God, you won't believe this date I just went on. I can't wait to see him again." And we ended up spending the next day together, and then we were just together ever since.
That was 23 years ago. Soon after Diane graduated from college, she and Greg got married, and they quickly started talking about having kids.
We bought a house, and it seemed natural to, you know, put a couple of kids in it. So my thought was that if I had my kids young, I could then go back to my career. So like Kenny was born, I was 25. Thea was born, I was 27. I figured by 30, I'm back at my career. And that is not how things worked out at all.
When did you notice that there was something different about Kenny?
Well, he was, you know, he hit, you know, 12 months and he was... He had a smattering of words, you know, about 10 words that he was using. And then maybe at about 15 or 16 months old, my husband and I just kind of looked at each other and we're like, "When was the last time you heard Kenny say something?" you know, it just like suddenly dawned on us that he had just kind of stopped talking.
They took him to the doctor, but it took about another year for Kenny to be officially diagnosed with autism when he was 2.5 years old.
At that point, Theo was already 8 months old.
So you'd already chosen to have a second child.
Yes. And at the time, we were like, well, you know what? What's going to be really great for Kenny is that, you know, Theo is going to be here to, like, be this great role model for him. And then Theo was about 16 months old. And by this point, you know, now we knew what to look for and, you know, how to judge these things. And I remember my husband and I each sitting next to Theo, and he's playing with blocks and like putting them in a row or something, and we're like, Theo, 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 and getting absolutely no response. And we just looked at each other and we were like, well, okay, here we go again.
Both of Diane's sons struggle with speech, but they have really different personalities. Kenny was a pretty laid-back little boy. Theo wasn't.
Theo was a nut. He used to beat up everybody. When he was 6 years old, he put his teacher's arm in a sling. He would go off about anything. So we would just be, it would seem to me like everything was just going as normal, and all of a sudden he would be desperately upset. And my first reaction as a mother was to try to connect with him, right? You know, you get down on their level and you get in their face and you're like, sweetheart, it's okay. I don't even know what's wrong, but I'm going to, you know, it's okay. I'm here. And what I had to learn was that made me vulnerable, because when I got down on his level, he could now smack me in the face in places that really hurt. So I had to learn to disregard my own maternal instincts.
So you had to think about your personal safety.
Yeah, you know, but you know, we started this therapy relationship development intervention, and it helped me to understand where he was coming from, and I, you know, understand that what we were dealing with was just such tremendous anxiety that he would just explode.
Diane pulled both Theo and Kenny out of school and taught them at home. She'd already cut her work hours down to part-time.
There's just not enough services to make it possible for you to be able to go to work all day. You know, so we'd have a helper, and then suddenly they say, oh, I can't come, my car's broken down. Or they quit because the payment through Medicaid, which is how we got those services, was just so low that they were always looking for another job. So, you know, my husband and I have tried numerous configurations. A lot, you know, most of the time has been me not working full time.
Why did you end up being the parent who worked less than full time? Did you choose that, or did it fall to you?
I think in some ways it made more sense, because I think for me, I wanted to be there. And my husband, you know, it just didn't, and it didn't work for him. I mean, for him, it's just very hard for a man to say to his boss, I need to work fewer hours, and, you know, still expect the same respect within the workplace.
Were you working because you needed the money, or because you needed to be working?
I was working because I needed the money, but I also did need to be working. I mean, it would not have been healthy for me to not be working, because it's very hard to have a social life when you have kids like that, right? I mean, moms get together with their kids, right? You go to the playground with your kid. Well, my kid's the lunatic who I have to be like right next to every second. I can't sit down and have a conversation with another mom because I'm always worried that he's going to beat up some other kid on the playground. So there was no social interaction opportunities for me. So being able to work it probably is what kept me sane through that entire experience.
Diane also started going to church, even though she hadn't gone regularly when she was growing up.
And I found that being in service and just kind of having that quiet time, having this quiet hour and a half, was so something I needed. Mm-hmm. But people were asking her prayers about all kinds of things. And I would be like, okay, if this is how this works, let me do this, you know? And I would pray and cry and cry and cry and cry and cry and cry and pray. And I'd just be like, just tell me what I'm supposed to do. And at some point I realized that I was beating myself up in an effort to impress God. I was making myself feel worse. And over the years, I found that I have become not just like fully atheist, but like devoutly atheist.
Why?
Because if I have to accept the idea that somebody chose this for me, I can't accept that. I can't get there. This is too hard. But if I can just accept that it's just, you know, a accident of biology, I can do that.
Did anyone at church ever tell you this is God's plan? Everything happens for a reason.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, everybody says that. Oh, God, everybody says, you know, God only gives special children to special people. To which I say, well, then God can go fuck himself. that's not a thing.
Coming up, how Diane is planning for her kids' futures and her own.
You know, right now our current plan is not to die because I don't know what would happen.
One in 68 children has autism spectrum disorder, according to the Centers for Disease Control. And boys are nearly 5 times more likely than girls to have autism. The group Autism Speaks estimates that autism costs families about $60,000 a year on average. A listener named Marlene wrote in about autism in her family. She has 3 children, 2 sons with autism, and a 16-year-old daughter. She and her daughter sent in this voice memo.
I think I came to learn about what it actually was called in maybe like fourth grade maybe. I didn't think it was anything bad though. It was just...
It wasn't bad.
It was just something that they had.
Yeah. And what do you think that you find most difficult about having brothers with special needs?
I like to think of myself that we do have our spats, we're siblings, we're always going to have that, but I'm always concerned that I'll hear more stories about kids not interacting with them because they're too freaked out to approach them. And as their big sister, I want to take care of them too.
You can share your story with us anytime. Just email deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. On the next episode...
When I started realizing how satisfying it was living alone, I personally found it intoxicating being by myself.
Last year, you shared your stories about what it's like to live alone. We'll revisit that episode and get some updates about what's happened since.
My living situation has completely changed, and a lot of things in my life have completely changed.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. Diane Gilmorris's sons are teenagers now. They have their routines down, but parenting hasn't gotten any simpler.
Go on back to the room. And when you're ready to eat breakfast, you let me know what you're going to eat.
Diane sent us this recording from a recent morning. Her younger son Theo is yelling in the background while she's trying to convince her older son Kenny to eat breakfast.
Stop it. Stop hitting your head. You need to go to your room. No, let me go. Talk to you when you're ready to eat. Puberty is awesome, by the way.
What changed with puberty?
Oh, I mean, Kenny was like this really sweet kid, and he hit about 14 and a half, and he turned into, like, it was just like, he got pissed off about everything. He would start smacking himself in the head. Most of his aggression was towards himself and towards the walls. The walls have taken quite a toll. And it only got worse. The more I interacted with him, the worse his behavior got. So I had to change my approach. So now when he starts getting mad about something, I tell him, I am not interested. You need to go to your room. And he recognized that he needed to learn how to keep himself under control because I had to make it his responsibility. I can't control him. He has to learn how to control himself. Kenny, now that he's 16, he is very soon going to be a young Black man. He is. I mean, he's 5'7". He is a young Black man, and I am still trying to figure out how I make sure that he is safe in the world. When I can't explain to him all of the intricacies involved of what it means to be young and Black in America. For me personally, I feel like it leaves me isolated. There's a lot fewer, the community of moms with special needs kids that's actually like organized and together is almost entirely white. These are the moms who, a lot of these are moms who get to stay home, and they tend to make relationships. And a lot of the minority moms that I know who have special needs kids work.
Have to work.
They have to work. And they don't have the opportunity, the time and opportunity to make the same relationships. I'm guessing that might be the reason, but we're friends on Facebook and everything. And I see them all, together for their little, night out or whatever. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, I'm glad they're enjoying themselves. I would have liked to have gotten out tonight, but whatever, kind of thing.
You're not invited.
But yeah, but it's like, I'm just not on the list. And I don't know that we would all be friends anyway. I mean, I don't know these women like so well that I would say, oh, we would all be best friends if they would just invite me or something like that. And, legitimately, maybe they just don't like me, which I think is a totally valid reason not to invite someone. But
you don't know.
But you're right. I mean, and this is kind of like the reality of my life, because I'm mixed. And my mother is white, my father is Black, and I've kind of spent my whole life as that person who wonders, was I excluded just because they didn't want me there, or was I excluded because it never occurred to them that they would, it never occurred to this group of people that they would include a Black person.
When you feel down, what do you do?
I have a bottle of gin in my cabinet.
Really?
Yeah. My mother won't want to hear about that. I drink probably pretty regularly. It's just the tension of meeting their needs and, making sure that everybody's okay. And it builds over the course of every day. And, by the time the day's over, good God, you need a drink. and that's, that's just kind of how you get through the day. In fact, this I've found to be pretty common amongst special needs moms. A good number of us polish off half a bottle to a bottle of wine at the end of each day. That's not uncommon.
Do you drink with your husband, or is that like your special alone time?
No, he doesn't really like to drink. Because he just doesn't see the need. He doesn't have that need. He doesn't let things get to him the way I do.
How has parenting changed your marriage?
Greg and I have been together since I was 18 and he was 19. And, I can't say that I knew that I had a man who could go through something like this and be strong. He does bedtime every night, unless he has to be someplace. I hear them in the bathroom and he's being totally silly and they're giggling together, and he's just such an amazing partner. And I think, you know, the hard part is not having the time together that we thought we would have by the time you have teenagers. You know, by the time you're a teenager, you're thinking that you're going to get to go away for a weekend together or go out to dinner or things like that. And we do get to do that occasionally, but it's much harder to make it happen. We don't get to go away. That's not an option.
When was the last time you traveled together, just the two of you?
Once. I think I was pregnant with Theo. So I think we only had Kenny at that point. We went from Raleigh to Winston-Salem, North Carolina for a weekend. Mm-hmm. And that was it. I mean, so what we've done a few times is where we do a hotel night in town. We did a weekend once where we spent two nights at the Embassy Suites. That was like 5 miles from our house. So my parents were with the kids and, you know, we could be there in less than 10 minutes if something happened.
Do you ever dark humor jokes, jokes where you're making fun of your kids each other?
Totally. I mean, like, you know, yes, we routinely make fun of our children, because, I mean, they do things that are just like ridiculous. And, you know, it's like, what else can you do? You know, I mean, this is like the weirdest thing is that, you know, they are difficult and stressful and, you know, a constant challenge. And yet they are sweet and loving and funny. And they kind of do their own versions of jokes. Yesterday, Kenny and I are making oatmeal cookies. Then I say, okay, next up is baking soda. And he looks in the cabinet. And he like gets a smile on his face and he pulls out the honey, which is in one of those little bear shaped jars. He knows that's not baking soda. He's done this a million times. And he just smiles at me and he's holding the honey and he's like waiting for me to react. And we're our heads are getting closer together until our foreheads touch. And then I'm just like, that is not. And before I can even finish, he just bursts into laughing. He just, he completely cracks up. I mean, for him, that's his version of a joke, you know? And I thought it was awesome. I thought it was great. And I told my husband about it when he got home. And they're just amazing people. And, you know, I am constantly astonished by how they have managed to evolve despite all their challenges and how they've pushed through difficulties.
So I hear you say that, Diane, and I think back to how we started this conversation. Yeah. I think back to you also being pretty clear that if you'd known what motherhood would be like for you, you wouldn't have had kids.
Yeah. And that's still true. I mean, when I think about my life, what I wanted for my life, this is not it. You know, I wanted a career. I wanted to travel. I wouldn't have chosen this path because I had to give all of that up. And I can't, and I don't even know that that's ever going to change. I mean, I don't know that there's going to be a place for them when they're adults. I mean, that still has to be my priority as a mother, no matter how old they are.
Or how old you are.
And no matter how old I am, yes. That's where it gets hard. I think, it shifted. When they were little, it was all about trying to figure out how to help them. How do I help them? How do I help them be better? What should I be doing? I don't know what to do. And trying to figure that out. Now it's, okay, this is who they are. I can continue to help them grow and evolve. And at least now I kind of have some understanding of what that entails. But the hard part is just accepting that this is quite conceivably the rest of my life.
Do you think you and your husband mourned what could have been at the same time? or did it happen at different paces?
I don't know. I mean, it's funny. It's not something that we talk about that much, because I think we're just both very aware that it's there. I mean, the most heartbreaking thing my husband ever said to me, and this was years ago when the boys were small, you know, he just goes to me one day, "I could have been such a great dad." And he is a great dad, but I understand what he means. He's just like, we could have raised these like really amazing young African-American men, and we would have made sure that they were well educated, and we would have made sure that they were, you know, respectful and intelligent and, you know, had lots of great experiences and all this stuff. But, you know, you have to push so much of that down. I mean, it's a bizarre experience to essentially mourn the loss of someone you never met. But, you know, you can drive yourself crazy with that, you know, because these boys are right in front of me and they're beautiful and sweet and amazing. And, you know, they deserve a mother who's not sitting there thinking, "I wish you were somebody else," because, you know, that's not fair. This is who they are. For whatever reason, I don't know. But yeah, you know, they are my children and I love them and I will do whatever it takes to make sure that they're okay. And that's what I have to focus on.
That's Diane Gill Morris. She's a mom and freelance writer from Cary, North Carolina. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios. The team includes Katie Bishop, Emily Botine, James Ramsey, Destry Sibley, and Rick Kwan. Special thanks to Stephanie Joyce for her help on this episode. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Twitter at Anna Sale. The show is at Death, Sex, Money. And you can email us anytime with feedback or a story to share at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. Says what's hardest is not knowing how or when things with her family might change. So I asked her, what would make your life easier?
Wow, that is an incredibly big question. The only thing I can think of would be $1 million. $1 million would make, like not having to worry about that. A couple million bucks, that would make my life easier. You think you can hook me up?
Well, you said a million at first, and then you said a couple million.
I know. I started to calculate. I was like, well, I got two, so I need to rethink that. Maybe one isn't going to be enough after taxes.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks.
To subscribe, just click try free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.